Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's been a lot of speculation on how the U.S. relationship with Afghanistan and Pakistan will change in 2014 when NATO troops begin withdrawing from Afghanistan. Much less has been voiced about the other countries in the region. My guest today looks at the importance of the Central Asian states, the stands, if you will, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkmenistan. Several have been important staging areas for the conflict in Afghanistan, and all are strategic for their location and their natural resources, primarily energy. And just as in the 19th century, they've become a buffer zone between great powers. During the 1800s, the great game was played by Russia and Great Britain, vying for control of South Asia. Today, the players are Russia, China, the U.S., Pakistan, and India to a lesser extent. Even Iran are all vying for influence over this area. My guest today is Dr. Charles Ziegler, a professor of political science and distinguished university scholar at the University of Louisville. He's a specialist on domestic, foreign, and security policies in Russia and Eurasia. He's the co-editor of The Russian Far East, A Region at Risk, the author of The History of Russia, Foreign Policy in East Asia, and Environmental Policy in the USSR, as well as over 60 book chapters and articles. He's currently editing a book on civil society and politics in Central Asia, an outgrowth of his work as a project director for a State Department-funded program on building civil society in Kazakhstan. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this month, and I spoke with him while he was here. Charles Ziegler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In your presentation to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, you related the situation today with the Central Asian states on the southern flank of Russia and once a part of the old Soviet Union to a situation about 150 years ago when the Great Game was going on, which was a sometimes hot war, sometimes cold war, always political intrigue between the interests of Great Britain at that time, who controlled Greater India and much of the southern Asia, and Russia at that time. You've likened that to the same sort of situation. What are the parallels?
Well, it is a great game today. I think you can call it that. It's very different, though, from what we see in the 19th century. Then it was a struggle for territory because Central Asia lay between the British imperial possessions in India and Russian expansion southward. So what you have today, I think, is less a struggle for territory because, as you said, there are these new states.
This is about the growth of empire, really, at that particular point.
That was the growth of empire. Now we're concerned more about issues such as security, relating to terrorism, to narcotics, issues related to Afghanistan because these countries border on Afghanistan, and development of energy also, because a number of the states have oil and gas. Kazakhstan has a good deal of oil. Uzbekistan has some oil and gas. Turkmenistan is sitting on a lake of natural gas. The outside powers, Russia, China, the United States, European Union, are all interested in that region, as are some of the smaller regional powers, Iran, India, Turkey.
And what makes it a great game times about seven, because you're alluding to just about, you know, everything from Iran in the south to China to the east, Russia to the north, the United States, the European Union, lots of forces vying for influence in this area.
That's true. For the United States, if we take the U.S. first, given our campaign in Afghanistan and the plans to leave that country in 2014, a major question for everyone, certainly for us, but for the other countries in the region, is what's going to happen with the situation in Afghanistan? Will it be destabilized? Will the Taliban return? And we have found in the past links between the Taliban or al-Qaeda and Islamist movements in Uzbekistan or in other parts of Central Asia, and those linking into the Caucasus. We see money coming from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia, to build mosques, to train imams. And so you see a number of countries who have divergent interests with some, I think, seeking to build up Islam in that region, and others, such as ourselves, Russia, China, and also the regimes of these Central Asian countries, worried about Islamic extremism.
And most of these regimes are secular regimes, correct?
They are adamantly secular. Kazakhstan, the leader there, Nursultan Nazarbayev, likes to...
He'd like to have his own religion, I think.
Yeah, there have been some articles recently about his cult of personality. But he really promotes tolerance and actually hosts interfaith conferences. In Uzbekistan, by contrast, you have a government which actively represses religion and probably in doing so generates the extremism that they're trying to counter. And the others are variations. Tajikistan has done some, I think, fairly ill-advised moves, such as outlawing attendance at mosques by children under 18 because they fear they're going to be radicalized. And moves like this tend to drive it underground and make it even more radical. And they open up opportunities for extremists from Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or the Caucasus and gives them entree.
Despite the number of these Central Asian states, you would think, you have Tajiks, you have Uzbeks. You would think that these were pretty homogenous states, but for the most part, they are an amalgam of peoples living under the umbrella. Even in, say, Tajikistan, very much a majority Tajik population, but there is a minority as well, a very small minority. So you have ethnic tensions that are also a part of these areas as well.
Each of the five states is very different. They're each unique. You can look at them and say, well, basically they are the same Turkic peoples, aside from Tajiks who are more Persian and speak a Persian language. They are Sunni Muslim. There was a fair amount of discussion early after the breakup of a sort of pan-Central Asian movements and pan-Turkic movements. This really didn't pan out because they were so different. And so you have Kazakhstan, which is really fairly wealthy. You've got a good middle class. Wealth is built on oil exports for the most part. You've got neighboring Kyrgyzstan, which is really poor, which lives off rents essentially from, say, the U.S. base there at Manas, or from drug money coming in, or from foreign aid. You've got Uzbekistan, which has a strong cotton sector and some oil and gas, but beyond that, which is pretty poor too, and where you've got maybe 5 or 6 million working age men who have left the country and who work in Russia or Kazakhstan or even in South Korea. And send remittances back. I mean, three of these countries depend very heavily on remittances from their workers living abroad, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. And then you have Turkmenistan, which is an extremely repressive, sort of personalistic dictatorship. Again, each is quite different. Turkmenistan's very isolated. Kazakhstan deliberately tries to buy into virtually every organization that they can find.
Mm-hmm. But the five of them often get lumped together, and I guess this is because
the stands.
Right? Yeah, the stands, mm-hmm. and they've been the buffer between the old, going back to the Russian Empire. They were always a buffer state. Today, they've been very important because of our involvement in Afghanistan, but that is winding down. Can we talk about the U.S.'s influence on these states throughout the last 10 or 12 years when we've been involved with Afghanistan? How is that likely to change once we pull out in 2014?
All right. So if we review what happened over the past decade or so, after 9/11, we established bases in Kyrgyzstan, outside the capital at a place called Manas, and in eastern Uzbekistan, close to Afghanistan, at a place called Karshikanabad. And we used those as staging areas for the campaign in Afghanistan. Now, we had links, say military-to-military links with Uzbekistan, which went back into the 1990s. So we had paved the way for that. However, at the same time that we were using these military bases to funnel soldiers and fuel and so on into Afghanistan, We also were criticizing the Central Asian states for their human rights records, for their slowness in democratizing, and they are all basically authoritarian states, with the possible exception of Kyrgyzstan. In 2005, this came to a head with Uzbekistan, where we criticized them fairly strongly over a massacre of some religious Islamic businessmen and their supporters in a place called Andijan in Uzbekistan. And the Uzbeks at that point, I think with support from Russia and China, urged or told the United States that we should vacate that base within 6 months, which we did. Uzbekistan then comes back after several years. They allowed the Germans to stay there. That's something that's often overlooked. And they took a large payment in euros to keep the German forces there. So NATO still had a pipeline.
It's just the United States was not involved.
The U.S. wasn't there. And then we came back after several years. And now we've reestablished the links with Uzbekistan. They just, a few months ago, pulled out of a security organization that the Russians control. And it seems like they're doing this because they value those military-to-military links. And it's apparently the U.S. will leave a fair amount of material in Uzbekistan after the withdrawal rather than bring it back to the U.S. It's actually more costly to bring it back. So, again, these are states that we needed to engage in the campaign in Afghanistan and that now we need as we leave the region.
But after we leave, will we really need these states too much? What's likely to be, how much are they likely to matter to the U.S.? Because when we think of these states, we think of this sort of in the Russian sphere of influence, if we go back to the old Cold War terms. How important are these states once we do divest ourselves of the conflict in Afghanistan?
Well, if you like to think ahead and think through different scenarios, there is some potential for Islamic radicalism in the area. And so, for example, if the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, would undergo a resurgence, let's say the Taliban comes back, takes control over at least part of Afghanistan, strengthens the links into Uzbekistan, and we could see that become a haven for extremism, possibly for terrorism. We have the experience of having built up an opposition movement in one country, Afghanistan, over a period of years and then walked away from it, and we saw what happened there. So I don't think it's in our interest to simply walk away from the region.
And really, from that experience, what a lot of people are taking away today is much less what happened in Afghanistan, but what happened to our relationship with Pakistan, which is now really at low ebb, even though it seemed like it was initially coming back after 9/11, we find out all these tensions, and that goes back to the last time we left Pakistan after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
Well, we often don't understand what the interests are of these countries. I mean, we have our interests, they have theirs, and they're often very different. For Pakistan, their major enemy is India, and they want Kashmir returned. And so the ISI, the intelligence service there, has funded what we would call terrorists to go in and attack Indian soldiers and Indian facilities in Kashmir or in India itself. And so these two countries are also very much aware of what may happen in Afghanistan after we leave. And so the Indians are trying to position themselves. The Pakistanis, of course, want to counter the Indians. And that's not to mention the fears that China and Russia have of how the region may destabilize after we leave.
And both of those countries also fear Islamic radicalism because they have ethnic minorities in their countries as well.
Sure. If you look at a map, Xinjiang province in the west, very large region, borders on Central Asia. It is about half made up of Uyghur, the minority there, Turkic Muslims, like the Central Asians are. There are tensions between them and the Han Chinese who have moved in over the years, who are developing the oil and gas in that region. And there have been, terrorist movements and links between Uyghur, the East Turkestan movement, and the Taliban. And so China is very afraid that this western part of China could possibly separate from China, or at the very least that there would be continuing tensions. There were major riots in 2009 with several hundred killed. So that's a big security interest. For Russia, of course, this is right on their southern border, and it can feed into the Caucasus, where there's a simmering Islamic low-intensity conflict that's been going on for years now.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Ziegler of the University of Louisville. He's a professor of political science and a distinguished university scholar there. He specializes in domestic security and foreign policy in Russia and Eurasia. He's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, the United States has entered into this area very much since the breakup of the Soviet Union. First, it was all about energy issues, and then certainly after 9/11, it's been security issues. How big of an irritant has that been in U.S.-Russian relations that we're, you know, we have bases in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, which until just a few years ago was part of the Soviet Union? How big of an irritant is that in our relationship?
It is an irritant now. It wasn't always. In the 1990s, Russia basically didn't care.
Well, Russia was weak.
I mean, they were weak. They had their own problems. They had inflation. They had unemployment, just trying to transition that economy toward a market system. They had problems elsewhere. They didn't bother with Central Asia. After a number of things happened around 2000. One is Vladimir Putin becomes prime minister and then president. A second thing that happens is oil prices go back up, and so Russia's revenues soar since they are a major oil exporter and natural gas exporter, and gas prices, as your listeners here know, are tied to oil.
I believe we call those the good old days, back when it was $9. Yeah, exactly.
But all this augmented Russian power, and then along with that, you have a growing sense of national pride in Russia. And so while Mr. Putin was really the first one to call George Bush after the 9/11 attacks, offered sympathy, and then basically indicated it was all right with Russia if we established these bases in Central Asia on a short term. I think Russia felt that, first of all, that we were overstaying our welcome there, that we were staying on way too long. And secondly, that, again, we made a major mistake, which I think most people would agree with, in going into Iraq, which diverted our attention and resources away from Afghanistan. We never finished the job. And so now, from the Russian perspective, you're left with U.S. forces in the region, continuing problems in Afghanistan, and now the U.S. withdrawing before the situation has really been stabilized. So it's, in that sense, it's not a very good outcome.
Now, as we look ahead, a number of these states have large energy deposits, whether it's oil or natural gas. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the 1990s, there was a great competition to figure out how to get those resources either to Europe or to open water to go wherever they need to go. Do you see that as being a big competition down the road if in fact, Afghanistan does stabilize to a degree? What's the situation as far as energy goes?
Well, there's a competition among the firms, and the firms, Russian firms, Chinese firms, and even our private firms tend to be backed by our governments.
Sure.
It's in our interest to support them. In reality, though, getting more energy onto the market benefits everyone. It's a world energy market. Certainly in oil, and it's becoming more so in natural gas. So as long as you have more oil coming out and from diverse suppliers, that's really in all consumers' interests. Now, Russia, as I said, it's a major exporter. China, like ourselves, is at this time an importer and probably will be. One of the major developments has been this growing Chinese presence, and much of it's tied to energy. Several years ago, a pipeline went on stream from western Kazakhstan all the way across the country and into China. About 3 years ago, a pipeline, natural gas pipeline, went on stream from Turkmenistan into China. And the Chinese have been investing in different energy companies throughout the region. And beyond that, they're building railroads, they're building tunnels, they're building roads. You see Chinese goods come in. There are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Chinese now in this region, which overall has a fairly small population. And that is one of the worries of the Central Asian states, that China is, you know, 1.3 billion people on their eastern borders. And you've got countries which have five, seven. I mean, Kazakhstan's at about 16 million, Uzbekistan at about 28 million. They're very small compared to China. And they're afraid of being dominated both economically and demographically by the Chinese.
You mentioned that relationship to the great game. Do you feel like there are five different countries with five different viewpoints, but do you feel like they feel like they're sort of the real estate in a great game?
Well, they realize that. Most of them, though, are very good at playing off the great powers and getting what they want.
I mean, they have us for security issues.
They have us for security, the Russians for security. The Russians have a motorized battalion in Tajikistan, for example, in addition to the U.S. and NATO forces, which are there. And we do cooperate with the Russians on drug interdiction. You know, Afghanistan supplies a lot of heroin.
Yeah.
Which goes through Central Asia, some stays. A lot of it goes to Russia. A lot goes on to Europe. So we have common interests there. But each of the Central Asian states follow what they call multi-vector diplomacy, which means that they are more than willing to deal with anyone if it is in their interests, in their business interests, or if it enhances their security. And there's some suspicion of Russia, certainly among Uzbekistan or Kyrgyzstan, I think, Turkmenistan also. There's a general suspicion of China, and there is,
but
for
not
the
enough
most part.
But not enough to turn down investment.
No. I'm just saying they're smart people.
Right.
And they work with these states, although they try to keep them at arm's length. I mean, they're small powers. They have to deal with great powers. And in any situation, you use what you have. And most of them play a pretty smart game of it.
I would think for the ones with energy reserves, I mean, you can see in the Middle East, small countries have outsized influence just because
exactly.
of energy reserves.
Yeah, look at Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
25, 27 million people. And it punches way above its weight because it has about a quarter of the world's conventional oil reserves. So, yeah, Kazakhstan in particular, I think, because of its oil, punches above its weight. Uzbekistan, more because we need them, again, for Afghanistan. And I'm not sure if your listeners know, but there's several routes called the Northern Distribution Network, rail and roads, which we use to supply Afghanistan. And those are particularly important when we have trouble shipping goods through Pakistan.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Ziegler of the University of Louisville. He's a professor of political science and a distinguished university scholar there. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations and our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You were involved with the State Department on, looking at sort of the emergence of civil society in Kazakhstan. And you said this is probably has the most advanced middle class among these five Central Asian states.
Yes.
Give us a sense of the differences, say, between Kazakhstan and, say, some of the poorer countries that don't have a lot of energy involved. Is there a big difference between these states?
There's a very big difference. If you just look at the statistics, I think Kazakhstan's per capita gross domestic product is maybe around $13,000, $14,000, which puts it up toward a middle-income country. And that means there are a lot of people who are shopping their nice, fancy, glittery malls, people who have bought houses where before they had the old Soviet-style cramped apartments. Still a number of fairly poor people in the villages, but overall the country looks pretty well. If you go to a place like Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, then you're talking about people who are quite poor, where the per capita income is perhaps $1,500 to $2,000 a year. So some real poverty.
They tend to be more agrarian?
They are much more agrarian. Mm-hmm. Uzbekistan grows a lot of cotton. In Tajikistan, there are different fruits and mm-hmm. so forth. But really the major cash crop there is narcotics, heroin. Mm-hmm. That comes from Afghanistan. That's the big money earner. It is a big corrupter also. So we do see corruption in all these countries. One thing that differentiates them, though, from some of the neighbors, such as Pakistan or Afghanistan, is that the Soviets, for all their faults and all the repression, at least they educated these populations. And you still see 97-98% literacy, where if you look at Afghanistan, the literacy rates are 30%. So that's a big difference.
Can you get us a sense? You said most of these governments, or in fact all of them, are authoritarian to an extent. Do you see any blossoming of a liberalization of their governments?
No.
From either a political standpoint or economic standpoint?
The only one, well, in economic terms, again, Kazakhstan stands out because of its market reforms, right, which, say, Uzbekistan, the other big country, didn't undertake. Kazakhstan has a pretty strong financial sector, in addition to the oil and gas. The only country that looks at all liberal is Kyrgyzstan, and they have had several turnovers of leadership, one in 2005, which looked like a popular revolution to overthrow the president. And he was replaced with another man who stayed in for 5 years. And then in 2010, we had both, what looked like a popular revolution combined with some ethnic cleansing between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks in the south of the country. Scholars who have looked really close at this make the argument that it's more a sort of clan warfare among warlords or among powerful village or clan leaders, and that they will mobilize their followers to oust other leaders. So to us, from our frame of reference, it looks like people in the streets, like the Arab Spring, they're demanding change and so on. When in reality, what seems to have happened in Kyrgyzstan is some of these, these powerful leaders spread the money around, a lot of it may be drug money, get their people out on the streets and undermine competing leaders. It's a more liberal sort of environment, and they now are trying to move toward a parliamentary system, but it's also very chaotic. It's also suffused with drug and criminal gangs. So certainly it isn't what we would call Western democracy.
Same sort of things we're facing in Afghanistan, too.
There are similarities, yes. Yeah. Quite a bit of regionalism,
clan
identities and loyalties. Mm-hmm. And that's where the other dictators in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, all are trying to maintain really strong central control because they feel if they don't have that, if they decentralize at all,
they'll look like
then it
Afghanistan.
Could spin out of control like Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's really interesting. Dr. Ziegler, thanks very much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Charles Ziegler is a professor of political science and a distinguished university scholar at the University of Louisville and a specialist on the domestic, foreign, and security policies of Russia and Eurasia. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this month. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa, and you can search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.